Friday in the middle of October, what do you like? Wall Street? Trade wars? Maybe a little monetary policy? We got that and more from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In New York City, one last time, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday, the 12th of October. Good to have you along, everybody. All right, so listen, take your pick, would you, for where you want to start in trying to figure out what went on this week economy-wise. The markets, the president and the Fed, the International Monetary Fund. Don't forget that one. So much to wrap up, so little time. Here to do it in the studio with me, or maybe I'm in the studio with them because I'm usually in LA and you guys are here. Lee Gallagher is at Fortune Magazine. David Gura is at MSNBC and NBC News. Hey.
Hi, Kai.
So, David, let me start with you and the markets. The banks gave them a little bit of a breather today. The major indices, they were up. But suffice it to say, the past couple of days, they just kind of spit up all over themselves.
Yeah, and we've had a good run market-wise. Yeah. So the kind of drops that we saw this week were startling to investors for sure. But I think what you're seeing are investors reckoning with what we kind of knew was coming. That is, the Fed was going to raise interest rates. Jay Powell, the new chair of the Fed, has talked about that. Looking at the economic fundamentals, you'd expect that it would be coming. So there was some jitteriness, and you saw folks processing that. I think there's some awareness, too, globally. You mentioned the IMF. We can talk about that a little bit more in a minute here. This is still a globalized economy, and as the president talks about his latest triumph, the new NAFTA, whatever it's called, USMCA.
There you go.
There's still a lot that needs to be ironed out. And there are plenty of investors, plenty of folks running companies who are worried about how all this is going to shake out in the end.
So, Lee, talk to me then about why everybody was surprised. Because rising interest rates have been the mantra. Everybody's been knowing it's coming. And yet the past 2 days, everybody just went, oh, my God.
That's the big mystery. Right. I mean, everything that has made markets go crazy this week has been with us for so long. Yeah. I mean, markets just completely shook off the trade war in August. And all this other stuff, interest rates, deficit, everything. And I think part of it is, we know that this has gone on for a really long time. Yeah. Everyone's thinking, are we too complacent? And I think that that's just, does the market know something that the economy doesn't know, which happens sometimes.
I
think the fears are unfounded. I think when we see Netflix and Amazon come out with earnings in the next couple of weeks, I think, who knows?
They're going to be strong and everybody's going to go, I feel better now.
Yeah, for now.
David, the president's chief economic advisor, Larry Kudlow, made one of his many appearances on the White House driveway yesterday. Said, look, the economic fundamentals are strong. We've got growth going on. And yet on maybe Monday or Tuesday, I forget, the International Monetary Fund came out and said, hold the phone. Trade war, tariffs, we're going to take our peg for global growth down a couple of notches. So there's a little disconnect there.
Yeah. I mean, front and center here has been the U.S. economy. It's been the Chinese economy as well. All these global bankers, economists are gathered in Bali for this big confab. They're hammering all this stuff out. Yeah. You're right. They reduced the forecast for U.S. growth and for Chinese growth in 2019. I think you're seeing that contrast that, again, we've seen for these many months now, that you have well-respected economists saying there are going to be risks to what's happening here, and you have members of this administration downplaying those risks. It's interesting, too, the division between those advisors to the president and the president himself. We were talking about Jay Powell just a moment ago, the Fed chair. You had the president earlier this week casting doubt, even answering a reporter's question, does he plan to fire Jay Powell? I didn't know that we'd gotten there. Yeah, this is a guy that he'd picked. So you have a president now watching these interest rates rise. Fair to say no president wants to see interest rates go up. But there exists still this division between the president and those who are advising him.
Yeah. Lee, that point about the president poking Jay Powell in the eye. Jay Powell told me on this program, I don't care what the president says, I'm going to do my job. But there is something about why it matters that presidents attack the Fed. It's not like it's never happened, but this is real now.
It really is. And right, he hasn't done this before. And Jay Powell has actually managed to be relatively out of the limelight since he took over. But who knows? I mean, this could be here one day and gone the next. Mm-hmm. I mean, we just don't know. Rising interest rates, it's a good sign. This is all a good thing. It doesn't need to be, it doesn't need to be such a bad thing. It's not crazy.
It's totally predictable, though, in the sense that this president has hitched his wagon to the star of the markets from day one. You've now seen a sizable downturn in the market this week, and he's looking for an excuse, someone to blame for that. That seems entirely predictable unto itself as well. He's somebody who does that often.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So seeing the market drop 800 points, 4%, whatever it is, he's looking for somebody to blame. This week, I think it was Jay Powell.
And we should point out here that the markets are back to where they were, not all that long ago. I should have looked up the number before I came in here, but this is normal and to be expected and arguably a healthy thing in any market rally.
I mean, you say time and time again, it's your mantra here. The Dow is not the economy. The economy is the economy. It's not the Dow. Markets go up and markets go down.
It's an opportunity.
He's showcased that time and time again, that unwillingness to engage with the fact that if it's going up, it's going to go down at some point.
Lee, talk to me for a minute about we're going to get to this later in the program. The trade war is still going on. The Chinese and the United States still can't agree on what to do about it. There is a corroding effect that over time will take some of the air out of this economy.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, 100%. And we'll start to see it next year. This is big. This is a big deal. And this is now that the tariffs with China have been vastly expanded and maybe vastly expanded again. Mm-hmm. This is dramatic. And it's actually amazing that it hasn't impacted the markets until now.
All right, we're going to go back to a favorite of mine that actually was suggested by a Twitter user, Twitter fan of mine this morning. He said, listen, let's do What is Jay Powell Thinking in Five Words or Less? Which used to be, of course, the popular game show known as What is Janet Yellen Thinking in Five Words or Less? So, David, I see you counting on your fingers. Go. Jay Powell is thinking today what in five words or less?
How about how to keep him at bay? That's six letters. Sorry. Six words.
How to keep him away.
Keep him away. There you go. Keep him away.
Okay. All right. Lee, what is Jay Powell thinking? Five words or less.
This is like a haiku almost. I know. Stay the course calmly. That's five syllables.
Lee, she's a writer.
Part of haiku.
Lee, both those are very good.
Lee Gallagher at Fortune Magazine, David Gurr from MSNBC and NBC News. Give me the plug here, David. New show for you tomorrow?
Yes, new show starting tomorrow, 8 a.m. Eastern Time.
Up with David Gurr.
Get up at 5 a.m. California time.
I will not do that, but I'm a big fan anyway. David, thank you. Lee, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Kai.
On Wall Street this week and today, you want to know how to pronounce the word stocks? Try this, volatility. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We were talking banks just a little bit, David and Lee and I right at the top there. They did act as kind of a market reassurance mechanism today, but there's lots to pull apart in some of those profit reports, starting with this. How the heck does a bank like J.P. Morgan report earnings that were up almost 25% from the same quarter a year ago? Well, two words, you and me. Marketplace's Justin Ho is on it.
For years, big banks made profits from things that didn't look much like traditional banking. Trading, mergers, complex derivatives. Chris Zaccarelli with the Independent Advisor Alliance says banks are now turning to a more familiar business model, taking money in and lending it out.
Mortgage banking to individuals, personal loans, and or maybe credit card activities.
J.P. Morgan reported that consumer banking profits jumped by 60%. Citigroup and Wells Fargo showed similar numbers. Greg McBride with Bankrate.com says analysts actually wanted banks to issue more loans.
Writ large, loan demand has been at a much slower pace than what would be expected for this stage of an economic recovery.
A stage where interest rates are rising, which means banks can charge more for auto loans and credit card balances. Dave Mann at UC Irvine says it helps that banks aren't paying out much interest either.
I actually opened up a bank account for one of my children about a year and a half ago, and he's earned 0% on that to date.
While savers haven't been earning much, household debt has been rising. Data from the New York Fed show credit card balances rose by $14 billion last quarter. And that debt gets more expensive, Min says, as interest rates rise.
So in the abstract, rising rates reduce the purchasing power of consumers. But the real question is, why are rates rising?
He says the Fed keeps raising rates because the economy is growing. And if consumers keep demanding loans, that's a win for banks, as long as consumers feel they can afford to keep taking on that debt. In New York, I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
We've been talking a lot on this program this week about rising interest rates, as you have heard, and we've been doing it because it's true, but some perspective is in order. This week, the Mortgage Bankers Association said average rates on a 30-year fixed mortgage hit 5.05%. That's a 7-year high. But very recent history notwithstanding, that is still pretty darn low. Marketplace's Amy Scott has the reality check.
When Stephen Lynam bought his first home in El Paso, Texas in 1982, the interest on his adjustable rate mortgage was, wait for it,
15.5%.
That's right.
15.5%.
And that was pretty good then. The year before, in 81, the average on a 30-year fixed-rate mortgage topped 18% as the Fed made borrowing more expensive to try to slow down double-digit inflation. While the early 80s were extreme, it's only been in the last decade that rates have fallen below 5%.
We bought our first place in the late 1990s when rates were between 7.5% and 8%.
Michael Frattantoni is chief economist with the Mortgage Bankers Association. He says it's important to think about mortgage rates in the context of overall affordability.
Where are home values? What's happening to household incomes? And then mortgage rates as the third leg of the stool.
With prices rising twice as fast as incomes, he says, homes are less affordable now than they have been in a decade. But Danielle Hale, chief economist at Realtor.com, says that could change.
I think as mortgage rates move higher, we will see price growth slow because that makes financing a home more expensive. And unless incomes pick up dramatically, you can't have both higher prices and higher mortgage rates.
That first house Stephen Lynam bought cost just $36,000.
You can't buy anything that's habitable in most places for $36,000 anymore.
Not adjusted for inflation, that's about what he just paid for a new Subaru. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Mortgage rates might have risen to a 7-year high, as Amy was saying, but they topped 18% back in the early 1980s. Now, why do you suppose they got so high? We took a look at what the economy looked like back then. You can check it out at marketplace.org. It's been a while since there's been news of health care policy, Obamacare specifically, the Affordable Care Act, but there was some this week. For the first time since the ACA became law, which is 8.5 years ago now, premiums are going down for most policies sold in the federally run exchanges, 1.5% for next year. And on top of that, there are insurance companies that are going back to do business on those exchanges only a couple of years after insurance companies had been leaving. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore explains what's going on.
Premiums are going down a little next year because they went up an absolutely insane amount this year.
These plans whose premiums are going down by 1.5% on average in 2019 went up by 36.9% on average in 2018.
Larry Levitt is senior vice president at the Kaiser Family Foundation.
You know, these premium decreases are really about returning excess profits.
Insurers raised premiums so much a year ago because they were very freaked out.
There was a lot going on back then. There was a repeal and replace debate. President Trump was out there talking about the law collapsing.
Congress and the president ended certain subsidies for low-income Americans. So to prepare for that and for just chaos generally, insurers raised rates a ton. And then things turned out to be not as terrible as insurance companies thought. For starters, Republicans failed to fully repeal Obamacare.
Many insurers may feel like they've weathered the storm a little bit.
Sabrina Corlett is a research professor at Georgetown University. She says Congress is probably not going to try to destroy Obamacare again. Secondly, as some federal subsidies ended, other federal assistance programs kicked in. Corlett says most people didn't appreciate that would happen.
So what we saw is that enrollment actually stayed remarkably stable this year.
In fact, according to the Kaiser Family Foundation, insurance company profits are higher than they were before Obamacare. Some insurers are returning to markets they'd abandoned. But Corlett points out, yes, insurance premiums will fall by 1.5% next year, but they're still 30%+ more than they were last year. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Coming up.
This is not a drill. This is real. We need to prepare. We all need to get ahead of this.
I know it's been one of those weeks, but as Lee was pointing out, the trade war, oh, it is still happening. First, though, let's do the numbers. All right, here you go. The Dow up 287 points, 1.1% this Friday, closed at 25,339. The NASDAQ gained 167 points. That is 2.2%, 74.96. The S&P 500 up 38 points, 1.4%, 27.67. For the week, though, the 5 days gone by, The Dow dropped 4.2%. The NASDAQ dropped 4.8%. The S&P 500 gave back 4.1%. General Motors off 1.6%. Today, Ford slowed 1.9%. Both automakers have seen their manufacturing costs rise since the U.S. imposed tariffs on steel and aluminum, as we have been telling you. Tobacco stocks withered after the U.S. Food and Drug Administration restated its previous focus on cutting the nicotine content of cigarettes. Philip Morris drifted down 0.2%. Altria gave back 1.7%. Bond prices fell. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 3.16%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hey, it's Molly Wood, and I want you to listen to a podcast I host with Kai Ryssdal. It's called Make Me Smart. Each week, we connect the dots on big issues in tech, the economy, and culture. And this week, we've got something special, a fan favorite, our Explain-a-thon, where we answer as many questions as we can from you. Like,
and so I'm wondering, if tariffs are a tax, why does the president set them?
We even got a few of you on the phone in real time.
So, Jack, what's your question? What do you got?
My question is about what makes someone a publisher versus a platform, and what are the implications that come from being each one?
Subscribe to Make Me Smart on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your pods.
Now. Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, evolving your passions. We push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. This is the beginning of the new fall season for a lot of cultural and performing arts organizations around the country. And it comes just about a year after the first public allegations against Harvey Weinstein and the beginning of Me Too. And just like Hollywood and corporate America and journalism are reckoning with revelations of systemic sexual misconduct and other abuse, so too are cultural nonprofits. But for them, the financial implications are perhaps more dire. Janet Babin has that one.
New York City Ballet spends hundreds of hours rehearsing for a new season, like a team is doing in this run-through of the Tchaikovsky Pas de Deux, recorded here by the Kennedy Center.
Much better.
Good.
Good.
Everything needs to be perfect in time for the star-studded, money-making fall gala that's attended by Major League socialites like Gene Shafiroff, a staple on the gala circuit.
My husband and I attended the Metropolitan Opera Gala. We are patrons there at the opera. We love the opera. We had a fabulous time.
The Shafiroffs usually donate about $1 million a year to various cultural institutions and charities, including City Ballet. But arts organizations are concerned that patrons may think twice this year before giving after widespread allegations of sexual abuse. It started when the Metropolitan Opera fired conductor James Levine for alleged sexual harassment. Then, last month, the New York Philharmonic fired two musicians. But most shocking is a lawsuit against New York City Ballet brought by a former female student at its affiliated school against three male dancers and one of City Ballet's donors. The men allegedly shared nude photos and comments about the dancer. Again, here's Gene Shafiroff.
That's wrong behavior. I was very disappointed to see that.
The suit comes less than a year after City Ballet's leader, Peter Martins, was accused of decades of abuse. He retired, and the company is still without a permanent replacement. This new lawsuit alleges that City Ballet has created a culture that permits this kind of sexual abuse, with immunity for perpetrators, so long as ticket sales stay high.
The allegations are very serious.
Brett Egan is president of the DeVos Institute of Arts Management at the University of Maryland. He says with a budget of about $89 million, a third of that from individual, foundation, and corporate grants, City Ballet has an obligation to let patrons know their money isn't being used to exploit anyone. The organization says it is responding to the allegations. It's fired two of the dancers involved. Another resigned, though all deny the charges. The company's also donating the $12,000 it received from that donor named in the lawsuit to an as-yet-unnamed organization that supports women. City Ballet Executive Director Kathy Brown denies that the company knew about the sexual abuse.
No one here in this organization knew anything about it. No one would have ever condoned it, encouraged it, supported it.
Brown says all the major contributors continue to back the ballet.
Folks have given us their feedback, but I think in the main, they're still very supportive of the company.
Jean Shafiroff, the powerhouse socialite, says she'll probably continue to support City Ballet. But
if this continues to go on, of course, then I might consider changing my mind. I would imagine a lot of people are looking at the ballet very carefully right now.
At a recent performance, the packed house is looking pretty carefully at the ballerina and her partner, performing that classic Tchaikovsky pas de deux. The crowd demanded another curtain call. The show goes on, as does the lawsuit. In New York, I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
It's been kind of buried by the news deluge of the past couple of weeks, but the Business Journalist Code of Conduct requires me to mention that the trade war is still a thing. There is steel and aluminum with Canada and most of the rest of the world. There's Europe on a bunch of items, and then there's China, where the White House has to date published three separate but cumulative lists of Chinese imports subject to tariffs, most of which stand at 10% right now, possibly going up to 25% come January the 1st. Companies are trying to figure out whether they can pass those costs onto their consumers, whether they got to eat it, or whether maybe they can figure out something else. Because there are options, if you know who to ask. Ashley Milne-Tite reports.
Thank you for calling Mohawk Global.
The phones have been busy for months at this office in Syracuse, New York. Robert Stein is a consultant with Mohawk Global Trade Advisors.
We've seen a flurry of phone calls, emails, people reaching out to us, really in many cases in panic, trying to figure out what they can do to mitigate the effects of these new tariffs.
He says that interest has translated into 20% more business, and he's considering adding more staff. He's not the only one seeing an uptick.
Those questions just keep escalating.
Amy Magnus is with customs brokerage A.N. Deringer, headquartered in Vermont. She says companies from famous names to startups are scrambling to find answers to questions about their goods, such as...
Could it possibly be engineered differently and be classified differently?
So as to avoid tariffs.
Is it possible if we change certain parts of the manufacturing process that we could actually change the country of origin of the good?
Meaning it would no longer qualify as made in China. She says there's no simple answer to some of these questions, but that complexity is boosting Deringer's consulting business. MedSource Labs in Minnesota is one of Deringer's clients. The company makes medical devices. Todd Fagley is the CEO. He says when the Trump administration began announcing rounds of China tariffs, he and his colleagues got on the phone to their consultants, who said,
"This is not a drill. This is real. We need to prepare. We all need to get ahead of this."
Almost half of his company's manufacturing takes place in China. About 30 of its products have been slapped with tariffs. Many end up in this warehouse at MedSource Labs headquarters near Minneapolis. Fagley shows off one of his best sellers. It's also been hit with a tariff.
Actually, I'll take you to show you some tourniquets over here. The tourniquets are a really simple device. It's just a piece of elastic, but there's actually a little bit of tech in it.
He opens one of the boxes to reveal a bright blue band of elastic. You've had something like it around your arm anytime you've had a blood test. MedSource Labs sells more than 2 million of these a year.
But that's 10% increase going to 25% increase.
The question is, what to do now? He says he doesn't want to pass that cost on to the distributor and ultimately to the patient. One thing Deringer advised...
Figuring out how do we get more efficient manufacturing.
If they can save money on the manufacturing process itself, the tariffs won't affect them so badly. He's also considering moving some manufacturing to other countries. Fegley won't say how much the tariffs could cost the company because he says he doesn't know what's going to come next. Robert Stein of Mohawk Global Trade Advisors says the uncertainty is the worst part of this. Clients tell him all the time,
this is really hurting them because they don't know how to plan. And business is all about planning. How much do I allocate for raw materials? What kind of contracts can I sign?
They want to know what their expenses will be. He says with all his contacts in the industry, he used to be able to predict where trade policy might be heading. Now, he says, when a presidential tweet might change everything, he honestly has no idea. I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, in which drinking and driving still don't mix. Tesla, following a tease this past April Fool's Day by CEO Elon Musk, kidder that he is, the company has filed with the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office to trademark the word Teslaquila. Let me say that for you again, Teslaquila. There is no actual product on the market yet, but CNBC reports the company did file what is known as an intent to use trademark application. So I guess really the only thing to say here is, please, drink responsibly. All right, we are done. The Dow Industrials up 287 today. That's 1.1%. The NASDAQ gained 167. That is 2.2%. S&P 500 up 38 points, 1.4%. On the week, though, 4% or more to the downside, red all the way around. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Our executive editor is Evelyn LaRubia. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdal. Have a good weekend, everybody. We will see you again on Monday, all right? This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.